thanks to our sponsor, Nintex. If you could score an extra hour or two back in your day, would you take it? Because our friends over at Nintex want to give you a gift. The gift of time. Seriously, if you haven't checked out what Nintex has to offer lately, you definitely should. The platform built on Azure has evolved a lot. In just the past few months, the Nintex team has added new process mapping capabilities, and most recently, a new eSign capability called Nintex Sign, powered by Adobe Sign. Nintex also continues to revolutionize products you know and trust, including Nintex Workflow and Forms. With the power of Nintex, it is faster and easier for you to configure, not code, giving you valuable time back every day to spend it however you want. Test drive the Nintex Process Cloud at nintex.com. This is the Microsoft Cloud Show, episode 372. Today, AC and I are going to talk about some of Microsoft's legal woes, new devices on the scene, and some news, recorded live August the 13th, 2020. This episode is brought to you by AvePoint. If you like the Cloud Show, you will love the Shift Happens podcast with Microsoft MVP and regional director, Dux Raymond Tsai. Each week, Dux talks with one of the industry's brightest stars about their most challenging modern workplace or digital transformation projects. He uncovers the players, organizational hurdles, and last-minute surprises that inevitably arise when ambitious people try to impact their workplace. Season 1 features FedEx, Wells Fargo, Heathrow Airport, United Airlines, and other industry leaders. Go to www.avpoint.com/blog/shifthappens or search for the hashtag Shift Happens. That's one word, hashtag Shift Happens, wherever you get your podcasts, and subscribe today. Back to the show. Good morning.
How's it going, buddy?
Well, how about you?
I'm doing
pretty good.
What's
going on in your world?
Oh, just plugging away. I'm working on a new, I think I've probably mentioned this on the site. I can't remember if or on the podcast before, but I'm working on a new website for Voitanos. It's getting very close to being done. Almost all the content's migrated, and now I'm in the midst of playing with a new Azure service that I'm not sure if I'm going to use it or not, but I'm basically splitting my site into two different pieces. One piece is going to be the dynamic piece that's run by my membership stuff for e-commerce and blah, blah, blah. And the other side is going to be the marketing side. The marketing side is the new site, which is more of like the, you know, quote, .com site. But I've got a challenge in that they're in two different hosts. And so you could do two different subdomains, but then links are going to change for existing customers and stuff. And so now I'm looking at using something called, thanks to what you reminded me of, or you clued me into this, a service called Azure Front Door, which kind of acts like that. It's like a doorman, just stands there and says, what are you looking for? If you're looking for this, I'm going to send you over here. Otherwise, I'm going to send you over here. And the end user doesn't have a clue that they're going to different servers. It's like a reverse proxy.
Yeah. So. Yeah. I haven't used it myself, but I was reading about it the other day. And there's a few type of things like that, like HAR proxy and, oh gosh, the name escapes me. Another one I just had in my head now. Anyway, but yeah, being able to sort of facade a bunch of things behind the scenes, a bunch of services or websites and things, and use a product like Front Door to reverse proxy them all and make it all look like one sort of nice cohesive URL space out the front.
Yeah. If I end up using it, and if I've kind of got it working right now. Well, I've got 50% of it working, which is great, but I need 100% of it working. I need both sides working. So if I get it up and running and get it working, I end up using it, you know, come on the show. I don't know if we need to do an entire show about it, but I'll come around and talk about it and just kind of explain to people how it works.
Yeah, what you landed on.
Yeah. I will tell you that so far, I'm surprised at how quickly I was able to get what I have right now up and running. That's been very surprising to me. So
yeah, nice.
How about you? What's up with you?
Well, in my spare time, I've been playing around. I don't know if I've mentioned this before, but I've been, you know, I'm not a web developer, right? I'm not very good with front-end web. Like, I know nothing about it. Mm-hmm. And I've had a few sort of ideas bouncing around my head about a thing I wanted to try, build. And so in my spare time, I've been fiddling around with Blazor. Have you heard of that?
Oh, yeah.
Microsoft's Blazor. Mm-hmm. And it's an interesting concept. And so I've been fiddling with that a little bit. So the idea with it is that you can write C-sharp and it'll transpile it effectively to JavaScript, right? Mm-hmm. But the more interesting bit for me, and then that JavaScript you can run in your front end, right? So it can run as like web components, I think, in your front end. Or you can also have parts of your app, you know, for the back end as well. And the two can talk to each other with like all the sort of eventing and all that sort of stuff's taken care of. I'm not using it so much for the front end piece because I've just gone and got a component library with a bunch of, you know, graphs and tables and menu components and all that. So I'm not really trying to write all that stuff myself. I just sort of offload that to a bunch of component libraries to do.
Sure.
But the bit that I really like, or that I'm really liking, is that you write some front-end code, you write some back-end code, and sort of gluing the two things together, you've got to end up calling, you've got to write your own sort of API and all that sort of stuff. This has got a really interesting way of hooking events that happen on the front-end to actions that happen on your back-end, if that makes sense. And they use like SignalR and stuff like that to wire the two together. Mm-hmm. And all of that plumbing is taken care of for you. Mm. I found it really easy to prototype stuff fast because you don't have to worry about all that stuff. You just get writing your code and you don't have to worry about like how fancy is my chart going to be or my table or how am I going to send this event and payload back and forth. And I don't know if this is stuff that normal web developers care or worry about, but for me, it's like, I don't know about this stuff. But it's great that this is taking care of it for me.
No, I'm with you. I mean, it's the same kind of thing, similar thing to what I was working on with our site where I'm with you. Like the design side is I'm basically running around with no hands. I just, you know, just blocks for hands. Yeah. And I found a CSS, kind of a CSS component library, similar thing where it's an open source library like a Bootstrap, but then you can buy components to go with it. And it's just more like, for me, it's more painting by color, painting by number. And it simplifies stuff. It makes it's cleaner. It makes it work. Yeah. I mean, I know the designers out there are probably going to be like, oh man, you got, you know, something more custom or whatever, and some more perfect. And like, yeah, I get it, but that's not really what I'm going for. So
yeah, it's fast for me to play around with stuff. And yeah, there's great UI component libraries for it from lots of different vendors, and there's open source ones and all that sort of stuff too. So there's plenty available for it. Mm. So for an old C# timer like myself, it's been really good. I don't know if it's something you want to build a production system out of. I'm really not sure. I'm not at that point yet.
Yeah.
Right? Just playing around with things.
Hey, I had a scary Azure moment this past week that is...
Oh, yeah.
It's mostly resolved, but something else has happened that is kind of... got me a little more concerned. So out of the blue, I got an email from Azure, I think on Monday, and it was something along the lines of, if you don't do anything with this subscription, all the stuff's going to get lost from it. And I looked at the GUID and I'm like, that's familiar. So I go look at it and it's one of my primary subscriptions. And I'm like, what the hell? And it's like,
when you recognize GUIDs, you're in deep. Yeah.
There's a few characters at the beginning of two different subscription IDs that I have that are very much like, I know what that is. I know that that one is my tenant. And I know that that one's like, okay, C42. I'm like, I got that one. That's in my head. But so apparently what happened, I didn't realize this, but I had two Azure subscriptions from my MVP. And somehow I had gotten, somehow they had given me two of these and they had been assigned to two different subscriptions. And I didn't realize it. I just thought my Azure bill was really small on a couple ones. Mm. So one of them disappeared a couple months ago. Like, okay, I got it. I shouldn't be getting it. No problem. And so I tried to convert that over to a different subscription, as a pay-as-you-go subscription. And then the other one did it. But then when it flagged today or earlier this week, it indicated that the one where I have the most amount of stuff in, my Azure subscription, including my site, a lot of my business stuff is in there. It said that, you know, it was going to go away and the bill was past due. So I go in to go look at the bill and sure enough, it shows, here's your latest bill is past due. It was only 40 some bucks or 50 bucks. But when I went in to go make sure, like, why hasn't this been paid? Because it's got a credit card tied to it and it doesn't have a spending limit tied to it. So why hasn't this been paid like it has been paid every other month? I went into the payment options. You don't have access to it. So I log in using my old original, and I was logged in under my primary, my global ID, my main Azure AD account. So I jump over to my MSA account, which is the one that I originally set up my Azure subscriptions on years ago, and tried to access it. And it goes, it tells me the same thing. Like, you have to have, one of them said you have to be an owner. And so I went to the other one that was the owner and said, the other one said you have to be account admin. And I went over there and he was account admin, and they're both kind of pointing at each other. So I'm getting a little concerned. I'm like, I've lost control over my accounts.
You know, in your subscription, when you go in and it says type or something like that, did it say like pay as you go or Azure EA or
is it
what was it set to?
Pay as you go. And
oh, interesting.
And so I went and they were originally like Visual Studio Enterprise, whatever, things.
Yeah.
But they were now pay-as-you-goes. So I then went over to try to figure out a bunch of stuff, couldn't figure it out, even went to the old school account.azure.com site, still couldn't find it or couldn't figure it out. So I opened up a ticket, person got back to me and they're like, it looks like your subscriptions have become orphaned. There is no owner of your subscriptions. I was like, of my Azure subscription, there's no owner. She's like, no. I said, well, how does that happen? She goes, somehow it just fell off. Like, okay.
Somehow the front fell off.
Yeah, exactly.
Good one.
So I'm able to get in and I'm able to do everything I can with those accounts, including creating new resources. And that's when I created Front Door after this had happened. And so I couldn't figure it out. I could do everything, but I couldn't manage the billing stuff, which eventually the piper's going to come calling. And if I don't pay my bill, I'm going to lose everything. So they go look at it. They reparent both of the subscriptions under my Azure AD account. I can now see those. But in doing so, and being on the support call this morning, and they go, why do you only show four? I'm like, I only have four Azure subscriptions. They go, no, you have five. I'm like, I didn't know I had five. They show me this other screen that I can get to, and there's a fifth subscription that I can't see it anywhere else. And I've been paying for it. And it's got stuff
in it. Oh, interesting.
But I really can't get to it. I can't even get to the resources. And it's got my credit card tied to it too. And it's got a relatively recent credit card tied to it.
And weird.
So I was asking her, I'm like, what's in there? And she goes, I can't tell you what resources are in there. I can give you GUIDs. I'm like, well, GUID doesn't tell me if it's like a web app or something.
Oh, yeah,
like
I remember all those. Yeah.
So it does make sense why I've had about a $20 charge that's been leaked, that's been showing up on my credit card that I haven't been able to figure out. I just figured it was another Azure subscription, another like addition to something that I just couldn't track down yet. I think it was $20. I wouldn't get bent out of shape about it. But so now they're trying to figure out, like, they're like, this is your account. We see it, your account. We just have to make it to where it's parented to you. And now it's been parented to me, but it's not showing up in the portal anywhere.
Oh, man.
So it's like,
that's weird.
They go, are you sure it's mine? They go, it has Voitanos in the name. And I'm like, well, that's probably mine. So
sounds like yours. Yeah. Interesting.
It's a little scary.
I've struggled with, like, the invoicing stuff in Azure can be a little quirky. Let's put it that way, right? Like, if you've ended up like me, I've got lots of different subscriptions owned by different accounts, right, at different times. So, like, you know, different live IDs or different MSAs, for example, and org IDs with different subscriptions. And one of the problems I've got is when I get invoices for them, right, they get charged to my credit card. Mm-hmm. And some of them are work-related. So let's say the work-related ones, right? I get a charge on my credit card. And sure enough, you know, like most normal organizations, you have to provide a receipt for charges on your corporate credit card, right? So I go try to find an invoice for what's just a number on a credit card, right? It's got like, I don't know, $40.72, right? Let's just say for argument's sake. And it'll have some, if you go into your credit card company and look at the transaction, you might have some cryptic invoice ID, right? Which begins with like an E or something like that, and it'll be a string of numbers after it. It's like bending physics, trying to figure out how to map an invoice to a subscription.
Agreed.
Right? Because there's nothing in the invoice number that gives away what subscription it's about.
Right.
So if you've got like five different subscriptions on different accounts, and you've got Office 365 being billed to some of those as well as Azure, and I don't know if there's any magical invoice guru out there that knows how to decipher which invoices are for Office 365 versus Azure. That's your first question, right? And so basically I have to go brute force it. I have to log in to each Microsoft account and then go into each subscription in Azure and check the invoices and try to find one that matches the right amount and the invoice number. And then if that doesn't work, then I got to go do the same thing, but for all the Office 365 subscriptions and go check to see the latest invoices. And every now and again, I've got one that charges me $4.41 a month, right? Which is basically a single Exchange E1 license from what I can tell. It's an Exchange license. And I have no idea which subscription it is or where it is.
Yeah.
Like it's just some magical lost subscription somewhere.
Yeah. Or how to stop it.
Yeah. I've opened a support call about it, right? For $4 a month, right? It's hard to justify a whole lot of time, right? So it's like I've tried once and sort of given up. But I opened a support ticket about it. And they're like, we can't really do anything unless you're the owner. And I'm like, I don't know. Like, I'm being billed for it.
Yeah, yeah.
So I count myself as the owner. Right? But they don't see it that way. They're like, well, go in and you can go in and cancel, you know, take the payment thing off the subscription. I have no idea what subscription it is.
Yeah.
And they can't seem to tell me.
Yeah. Can just point me back somewhere. I can't see how that's a privacy thing. Like, if I'm paying for it, point it back to where it's supposed to. What subscription is it? And then let me start figuring out, you know, where that is. Like right now, I finally am able to find out that I have a subscription. I have a good for a subscription. I know it's my subscription. I know I'm paying for it. But now I can actually trace back and go, all right, so why do I not see this? How can I not get to this? And that at least take me to the next step. Don't just leave me off a cliff on a support call.
Yeah. I would like a little website from Microsoft where you plug in your invoice number and it will tell you what subscription it's a part of.
Mm-hmm.
That's it.
Like if you're as a vendor, you have that. You can go in as a vendor and I can plug in a PO number or I can plug in one of my invoice numbers and it'll help me find that trace back. But so what you're asking for is possible. It's not possible through the portal, but it is possible. Mm. When I spent time with the CSP group, what was that? Something, a cloud solution provider.
Being a CSP, yep.
They built an API and I built a course to teach you how to use the API. And part of that has an invoices section. And if you give me an invoice number, if the subscription that it's tied to is part of a specific partner, tied to a partner ID, then I can go back and I can figure it out, but only through the API.
Yeah.
So
I think that's part of my problem is because these subscriptions are spread over a bunch of different accounts as well.
Yeah.
So it's not like they're all under one account. I just can't find out which one it's for. It's more like I'm five or six different customers.
Yeah.
Right. I've got different accounts. It's a pain. I really got to figure out how to consolidate that. But
I spent one day going through and making sure that I had one account that was admin or had owner rights on every single one of my Azure subscriptions. So that now when I have that problem, I'm trying to figure out what the bill is. I now don't have to keep logging in and logging out. I can just use one account, but I'm still doing the subscription dance. So
yeah, nice.
All right.
Nice. All right, let's get on to some meat and potatoes of the show.
This episode is sponsored by ShareGate. Does managing cloud spending keep you awake at night? Trying to figure out how your budget is being spent is enough to give anyone goosebumps. Our friends at ShareGate understand that most cloud architects and developers want to create great applications, not count dollars and cents. That's why they built ShareGate Overcast, to help admin control Azure costs through transparency, collaboration, and simplicity. With anomaly detection, AI-powered cost forecasting, as well as personalized cost recommendations in a unified Azure governance platform, you'll see results from the moment you connect Overcast to your tenant. To start a free trial of ShareGate Overcast so you can get back to building big ideas, visit sharegate.com/overcast_CS. This podcast is brought to you by Raygun. Raygun provides full stack error, crash, and performance monitoring for tech teams. Whether you're a software engineer looking to diagnose and resolve issues with greater speed and accuracy, a product manager drowning in bug reports, or you're just concerned you're losing customers to poor quality online experiences, Raygun can provide you with the answers. Get full stack error and performance monitoring in one place. The next time you're struggling to replicate errors and performance issues in your codebase, think Raygun. Head over to raygun.com and get up and running within minutes and dramatically improve the online experiences of your users. And we're back.
You think people actually want to hear news, or do you just hear us ramble on about Azure complaints and what's cool and what's not so cool?
I don't know. Send us your feedback.
We've got some good stuff today, though.
I'm sure people have these quirks that they hit with Azure and Office 365, like these billing issues and stuff like that. And if you've got things like that that you want us to talk about, send us a tweet or what have you. Get in touch. And let us know and we'll discuss it.
That would be,
we'll see if we've hit the problems before.
That would be a great, give us your most epic. Here's one for you. Send us your most epic Microsoft 365 logistics issue that you've got. Not a technical thing or something like that, but stuff like this, just dealing with it. An invoice payment, something like that. And then do the exact same thing on the Azure side. That would be a great show to just like go on. Here's the, give us your war stories, right?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
That'd be fun.
So moving on to a little bit of the news, we spoke about Dataflex, or should I say the artist formerly known as Dataflex.
Yeah, it ain't going to be around long, is it?
Yeah, I'm not sure. Which was the new name for CDS Lite in Microsoft Teams or something like that, right? I can't remember. I saw some joke about it on the internet. Anyway. But it turns out Dataflex is a trademark that's owned by a company called Data Access Corporation, and they filed a lawsuit against Microsoft for, I think, trademark infringement.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, yeah, trademark issues with the name Dataflex. It's one of their trademarks. And the mind boggles how this happens, right? Because, or at least my mind boggles about how this happens, because naming stuff is a royal pain in the butt at Microsoft, right? It's hard. There's all sorts of hoops you've got to jump through. You've got to make sure you're not telling somebody they're an asshole in a different language, for example, when you name something. You've got to go through legal review. You've got to go through geopolitical review, right? So you're not like, you know, dealing with like, you know, Tibet and China issues or something like that, right? There's all sorts of reviews that stuff goes through.
Mm-hmm.
And so a faux pas of this magnitude seems very strange to me.
It's not, I mean, like the Metro one from years ago with the Metro UI was... that was pretty bad.
With the supermarkets?
Yeah. But Metro,
I think it was a supermarket chain or something.
Yeah, something, a supermarket chain, yeah. I think in Germany or in Europe somewhere. This one, though, is really strange because this word is not, like, Metro is more of a common word. This is not a common word. Dataflex is not a common word.
Yeah. Isn't that when you talk about how much bandwidth your internet connection has? You've got Dataflex.
This trademark has been filed for 40 years. It's been around since 1980. Yeah. And this company, and this one was interesting because you hear when someone like sues over trademark infringement, and like, is Microsoft selling this and making money on this yet? Is it really hurting this other company's business? And, you know, you kind of wonder, I get some of those lawsuits, but some of them, when they come out right away, saying you can't use our name because we have it and they're fighting this. The CEO of this company, I read an article where he was talking about how they've gotten, when Microsoft made this announcement, they got flooded with a bunch of things from their existing customers saying, how does this play with Power Apps? Can you actually show us how to do this? We didn't know you could do this stuff with this stuff. And they're like, what are you talking about? This has nothing to do with whatever you're talking about. This is this is the same product we've been having for a while. So you're right. It's very surprising that Microsoft has done this. And it's quite telling too that Microsoft has been pretty quiet since this lawsuit news came out, because it looks like they've kind of, I'm reading between the lines, I don't know if this is the case, but it looks like somebody at Microsoft just went, oh, crap, how the hell did we miss this? And someone's in a little bit of trouble.
Yeah, I'm sure of that. They've gone back to the project name. I can't remember what it was called now. They've started referring back to a code name as opposed to Dataflex.
So it's not CDS anymore.
Much like Cortex, right? So Cortex was not going to be called Cortex until like
the day
2 days before the announcement.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or a day before the announcement or something. And then it went back to Cortex. And... you know, call me a bit of a skeptic on this, right? But I suspect, actually, I'm not sure. One or two things could happen, right? Either somebody really screwed up, right, and didn't pick this, or they walked into it knowing there was a chance of a problem with this company and took their chances and either decided this will get held in our favor if it goes to court, and they've got some evidence to that, right? Or we'll do a deal with them.
Yeah, we'll just pay them off.
And settle out of court. If it goes to court, yeah. Like, I just have a very hard time believing that it got through all the legal review and all that stuff that you have to go through for this sort of thing at Microsoft without somebody catching it. There's no chance of that, in my view.
Mm.
So either they didn't go through the right hoops and just skipped all that stuff, and then in which case they really screwed up, or they did this knowingly, I think. It'll be interesting to see.
If it's the latter...
it'll get settled.
If it's the latter, wouldn't you have... thought that they would not have gone back to using the code name, like they would still be using Dataflex? Because it seems to me like if they've gone back to using the code name and they've stopped using the term Dataflex, that is almost like an implicit admission that, oh shit, we screwed up.
I would, maybe, yeah. I don't know I'm no lawyer, right? So I really don't know, but I suspect they've gone, hold on, well, let's not be complete pricks about this and look like us. To the judge.
I didn't know if like the oh shit was like there was a Latin term for like oh shitus or something like that. is that in like a legal thing? We're gonna exercise the what is it?
Caecilius and volubilis and shitus. Yeah.
Hey, okay. Corpus oh shitus.
That's right. man, we've diverged into Latin. Yeah, goodness me.
Yeah.
So yeah, who knows? But do you remember the SkyDrive debacle?
Oh.
They had the SkyDrive debacle as well, right?
Yeah.
Like, what was it called before that? The very first name was MyBerry, which never made it out of engineering, fortunately, which was going to be your personal library, and your MySite was going to be your MyBerry, which was just utterly comical.
Is that the one, when I share it with you, it would be ours, so it would be like our BroBerry?
Oh. Oh, dear. Homeberry. Yeah, interesting. So, but SkyDrive had legal naming issues too with like Sky TV or something like that. I can't remember who it was now, but something along that line. Every now and again, it pops up its head.
So we had another bit of news that came out this past week, and it's not really Microsoft Cloud news, but it is very big. It is Microsoft news here. I'm curious to get your take on this. I know we've talked a little bit about this offline.
Yeah.
But I'm curious to get your take on this. So we saw this announced, the Surface Duo, the Microsoft Surface Duo, which is, it is kind of like a really big phone, but it's got two screens and it opens up and it's got like the hinge. So
it's a book.
It's a book.
It's a little book.
It's like a little Moleskine notebook. Book.
Like, exactly.
It looks like a little Moleskine notebook, but unlike the foldable screen that Samsung phone that had the issues with, it's not a single piece of glass or whatever screen.
It's hinged.
It's got a hinge. It's got a seam right down the middle.
Yeah.
Like a book. So Microsoft announced it. I think that the date they said it was coming out was September the 10th is when it was going to be available.
Right.
But
you can pre-order.
Yeah.
They've just launched pre-orders.
And I didn't look too much at the specs. I did see it doesn't have NFC. I did see it doesn't. And it's also $1,399.
Well, and that's for the 128 gig version. The 256 gig version is $1,500.
Okay. So I did not pick up on that. Okay.
And it's a...
So
it's $1,500 for the 256 gig version. It claims like 15 and a half hours of video time, video playback, 27 hours of talk time. We'll get to the whole talk time thing in a second. It's got Wi-Fi, Bluetooth.
11 megapixel camera.
LTE, with a bunch of bands, different bands. It's got a SIM card in it. 6 gig of RAM.
4K video recording.
Bunch of software. Where's its processor? I missed its processor. There we go. Qualcomm Snapdragon 855. So I was really looking forward to this.
You say that past tense.
Yeah. Don't get me wrong. I really want one still. But I was really looking forward to it, but I'm not now. And I'm probably, for a couple of reasons. One, $1,500. Get the hell out of here. You're smoking crack, Sacha. Come on, buddy. That's a really good laptop.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Like that's a full, like that's a really smoking desktop PC. Like you could build a lot of stuff for $1,500. You could buy a decent laptop for $1,500. Like, okay, so that's the one price. Second, I'm not going to replace my phone with this. There's no way I'm going to walk around using an iPad strapped to my face for phone calls. That's just absurd. Right? It's not big. It's not as big as an iPad,
yeah.
Right? It's relatively small, but it's still pretty big. I'm not sticking one of these in my pocket without it being super awkward with people, right? I mean,
how big are your pants?
Yeah, I'm going to need a bigger pair of pants, that's for sure, with this thing in my pants. But so that's the second thing. And then the third thing is, the reason I was really looking forward to this was because of travel and conferences,
mm-hmm.
and I'm just not doing that anymore.
Yeah.
I would... This is my perfect device for conferences, right? This is, I don't like carrying a bag when I'm at a conference.
Yep.
I really liked my iPad mini because I did have a pair of pants with a back pocket that I could put the iPad mini just fit, right? And so I could walk around with an iPad mini. It was perfect. This is a bit smaller than that. It's even better. Great for taking notes, can do email, can do all sorts of apps. It's Android, right? So it's got a ton of apps on it and the ecosystem's good. It'd be perfect for me for conferences. So, but I'm just not doing that right now. So I don't have the need.
Yeah, I don't really understand this. And I get that people...
So polite.
So here's the thing. I mean, I have two issues with it. To be frank, mine boils down to three issues with it. First of all, the price. There's no way. I mean, entry level, $129, or sorry, $1,399. So $1,400, that's $400. Above the entry-level iPad Pro, 12-inch, the big iPad Pro, right? So maybe it's not dollar for dollar, but this thing is more expensive than the biggest iPad that you can get, the biggest, most modern iPad that you can get, not storage size, but just physically, it's $400 more. And like, not like $400, like we're talking like $400 more at like at a price point of like 20 grand. We're talking like 30 or 40% more than this thing.
Yeah, that's true.
So that's one. Another thing that I can't get with this is the usability doesn't make sense to me. So I get it. You open it up. You have this like book looking experience, which to me, okay, I want to be able to take notes on this. But I can understand being able to take notes on it. But I also, with OneNote, it makes sense. You get a handwritten thing, you want to type that out. But without any kind of a keyboard, a physical keyboard, all the videos I saw was to get the keyboard to show up, you got to flip this thing on its side instead of having using two-handed thing with this guy on the bottom. That wasn't going to happen. So if you flip this thing up on its side, the keyboard takes up what looked like one of the entire screens. So now you've got a much smaller screen that you're taking your notes on. That doesn't make sense to me. If I'm using a tablet, this is also, to me, it's going to be like a tablet replacement, right? Or a tablet competitor. So it's going to compete against my iPad. There's no way I'm going to watch videos on this thing because every full screen experience you're going to see, you're going to have this seam going right down the middle of it.
Yeah, that's true. Right? It's not a good movie device, is it?
I'm not going to write documents on this, or I'm not going to do like notes or serious note taking or writing or something like that. That's one of the biggest use cases I use my iPad for. So I grab my iPad, I leave my laptop at my desk to be able to do office related stuff. So writing articles, writing blog posts and stuff. There's no way you're going to do that with this split screen right down the middle and without having a hardware keyboard. So that's going to be a second device I'm going to have to grab as a keyboard, a Bluetooth keyboard to go with this, assuming that that'll pair with it. All of those usability things, they just don't make sense to me. When I go take this and compare it to an iPad, I can't see why I would choose a device like this over an iPad mini today, especially when I look at the ecosystem.
Interesting.
There's so much stuff that isn't making this more compelling. And if anything, it's make it more compelling on price. Because an iPad, like a maxed out iPad, is more than a laptop. My iPad that I have is a nice laptop price, but I also use it a ton. And this, I'm like, I have a hard time knowing when I would use it. I use my iPad at the house all the time. All the freaking time. Every day I use it. At my desk, I use it. Downstairs, I use it. I use it when I go take the kids to swim and I have to wait for them. That's the device I'm going to take. I'm not taking my laptop. I can't see myself grabbing this thing all that often. I would like to, like you, when I go to a conference now, I don't like carrying all my stuff around. If I'm presenting, I'll take my laptop, my backpack with me.
Yeah.
But during the day, I want to have something to take my notes. I take my iPad. I've got a 12-inch iPad. It's a little bit bigger than I would like to have at a conference, but I've got a little sling bag that I can throw it in the sling bag, throw it over my shoulder, and there's like no weight to it, but the battery lasts forever. And this doesn't swing the needle of me going, yeah, I'm interested in trying this. Would I like to pick this up and just see what it's like? Yes, but there's like zero appeal to go buy this.
Yeah. So like I said, I was really excited about this. And, you know, maybe if we get back to conferences, stuff like that, maybe the next, maybe V3, different price points, we'll see. But yeah, for now, that's a no from me, dog.
Did you see the number of apps that are preloaded on this thing?
Yeah, that's quite a lot.
My God, it looks like Lenovo got a hold of this thing.
If it pops up a thing for Norton antivirus, I'm going to throw it out the window.
Microsoft Office, Outlook, Teams, OneDrive, Edge, OneNote, To-Do, News, Authenticator, Bing Search. You know, you can't do Windows Hello with this for logging in.
No, because it's not running Windows. It's running Android.
LinkedIn. Yeah. Intune Company Portal, Solitaire, thank God. Surface Audio.
Solitaire.
Here's the fun one. Google Search, Google Assistant, Google Calendar, Google Drive, Google Duo, Google Photos, Google Play Movies and TV, Google Play Store, Google Maps, Chrome, Gmail, YouTube, YouTube Music,
Context,
HBO
calendar.
Max, AT&T TV, My AT&T, Call Protect, Amazon Shopping, NBA, Spotify. Like, holy crap, man. This is like, and I get that it's an Android device. You're going to have a bunch of Google stuff on there as well, but that 128 gigs, how much of that is left?
Yeah. It's got a whole bunch of junked up crapware on it already. Oh boy.
I hate to
be. Well, we'll see how it does.
Yeah, we will.
I mean, my love for it is a whole lot less because of no travel and the price. Like, holy smoke. You're smoking crack. Come on now. That's silliness.
Okay.
Changing tact a little bit. I've got two. This is kind of out of our usual stuff here, but I've got two sort of Excel things. So I don't know if you know Brian Jones from Microsoft. Yeah, used to work a lot in the SharePoint space. He leads Excel now. And he's been posting on LinkedIn a bunch about a whole bunch of new Excel stuff that they're doing. And, you know, at first I was like, Excel, yeah, okay. I don't really get it. It's not really my bag. But I'm sure Excel people are fizzing at the bung about it, right? Like they're just super excited. And I came across one that I thought was quite useful, that I've hit this problem before, that I thought I'd mention. You can now, in Excel, you can connect to a PDF file and import data from it. So say you've got a table of data in a PDF. I don't know, like stats from a medical study or something.
Financial reports. Right?
Or financial reports. Now in Excel, you can use the get data function or the get data sort of wizard, I suppose, or I don't know what you want to call it, and open from a file from a PDF, and it will open up a sort of a navigation panel that will show you all the pages. It'll find all the tables in the PDF, and you can pick a table to import that data into Excel, which I thought was pretty nifty.
That is cool.
You know, because otherwise you've got the copy-paste mess that never works quite right, and you've got formatting problems and all of that sort of stuff if you try to copy things from PDF or from the web or what have you. Anyway, so import from PDF I thought was quite curious, quite nifty.
That's cool.
But if you want more Excel tips, then there's a chap called Brian Jones, who I know from Microsoft. He's a good dude. He's the head of product for Excel. You can find all of his posts on LinkedIn. I believe he posts them publicly, so you could go check those out.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Sticking in the Microsoft 365 side, switching from Excel and jumping over to Teams. So Microsoft Teams has teamed up with the NBA Teams.
Yeah.
All right. A lot of teams coming here.
Speaking of Microsoft naming problems.
Yeah. Okay. Let's see. All right. So
this is a doozy. Yeah.
What Microsoft has done is they've partnered up with the NBA, who is doing their season right now in the bubble concept where all the players came in. They're all kind of isolated on a virtual island and they play their games, but they aren't interacting with anybody in the outside world. And that's allowing the NBA to hold a season, just like what the NHL is doing.
Yeah.
So what Microsoft has done is they've added these large LED video boards. I think they're 30-foot video boards that they've added to the back behind each of the billboard or each of the goals, basketball goals on either end.
Yeah.
And then they've also, it looks like they've also put them
on the sides as well.
Yeah, on the sides behind the teams. And that new experience that we have in Teams, the together mode, where it makes it look like people are instead of seeing like just tiles of pictures all over the screen, it looks like you're in an auditorium and it finds the pictures and actually puts them into the seats. Yeah. It's giving fans a way to, during a game, to be able to put fans in the stands while people are playing. Cool concept. I saw like the Formula One do this with their big fan video boards that they put up. Those are cool.
This is interesting, eh? Like, I mean, I'm not an NBA fan, so I don't really know how I feel about it. But when I first saw the footage of them playing live with these screens in the background, it didn't look like a real game. It looked like a video game.
Yeah.
It looked sort of like playing Xbox basketball on an Xbox. Mm-hmm. Like, I was like, man, are those people real? Like, is that a video game? So where do they get do you know where they get the footage of the fans from? Like, is it live reactions from people or?
I don't, I've tried.
Is it beamed in, recorded or?
I've tried to find that. Where are they, is it live footage? Are people actually watching the game while the game's going on? But if they're doing that, is someone screening this stuff before it's actually shown on the video, in the videos? And if not, then, I was talking to somebody about this and they're like, well, they should be screening the videos. And the other person's like, well, not really, because when you are at a normal NBA game, you've got somebody in the stands. Nobody's going through and censoring what they are or not doing. Like, yeah, but it's a little bit
but
different.
They can also walk over there and kick them out.
Exactly.
I guess they could kick them out of this as well. So
they could, but I mean, you know, is there like are you going to do a delay? So where when the game's going on, I'm sitting in the comfort of my room. I may do something in the comfort of my room behind the camera that I'm not going to do in a crowd in the stands. I'm not going to go like elaborate on what that might be, but you think about it.
Thank you.
Somebody may do something that's just really wrong there that gets caught on video. And it's like,
yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, it's interesting. I know I saw another thing where you can go into the NBA app and you can like tap to cheer, apparently, so they can beam in noise. You know, so the players, that's one of the weirdest, apparently this is one of the weirdest parts of it, right? Is like you're playing sport, you're used to having a bunch of people cheering and noise everywhere. Mm-hmm. The NFL are going to have the same issue, right? It's going to be it's going to really put players off. You know, you can't have silence in a stadium. It'll just freak everybody out playing. And it just won't feel real. And so, like, how do you build that atmosphere again and stuff? And I don't know. I've got a video on the YouTube of some of it. So I'm going to watch it after this and just see what are the sounds and stuff like that. I'll send you a link to the video I'm looking at.
Yeah, I'd love
to see it. The highlights of the Clippers versus the Nuggets.
It's interesting. I mean, baseball was doing something similar to this, but they were using like cardboard cutouts. And they, did you see the one, like somebody paid for a cardboard cutout of Bernie from Weekend at Bernie's. He's sitting there like he's dead.
Classic.
Like, oh, that's awesome.
That's so funny.
It's going to be so, 2 weeks. We're watching the Indy 500 with usually 300,000 people at the event, and there's going to be no fans.
Bizarre, isn't it?
600 people. That's it.
F1 have been covering the stands with like signage for stuff. Mm-hmm. And they've had those big screens with like, I think pre-recorded, like beaming fans in, like, yeah.
Yeah.
So that the drivers, it was so funny. Like they talked to some of the drivers about how they felt about no fans. And, you know, some of the really dry, boring drivers are like, I never looked at the fans. I was always focused on the race. And then like some of the younger, more fun drivers are like, yeah, it's really weird. Like often I'd be driving around, like maybe on the back straight or something. And like, you look up at the stadiums and you see all the fans cheering and it's like really cool. And so I got to, yeah, it's really weird. But then some of the boring drivers like, I never looked at the stands. I was always focused on driving.
Way to remember what you're there for.
Yep, exactly.
Oh.
Hey, another interesting one here we've got is about this thing called Azure Stack Fiji that I stumbled across.
Hmm.
And Mary Jo Foley posted about this past week. And it's sort of, so you know how Azure Stack was the ability for a customer to buy Azure Stack and run it on premises. And it came from a vendor and it was all full of hardware already. And you could sort of get a bit of Azure running locally, right?
Mm-hmm.
This is sort of a hybrid model, apparently, where it's sort of like Azure Stack, but more like Azure in that Microsoft provides the hardware and Microsoft runs it. And my guess is that, but it's still on customers' premises, in the customer's premises, from what I understand.
Okay.
And my guess is that there's a whole bunch of companies that have problems running Azure Stack themselves, right? And that want to outsource to Microsoft to run their data center, but they want the benefits of having it in-house as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is sort of that hybrid model of the two. And I was thinking, it's like, hold on, isn't this what companies did before the cloud?
Yes.
Like they outsourced their server room to an outsourcer who would run the hardware for them and would patch it and manage it and all that. So aren't we just like
full circle
back to, you know, outsourcing your data center operations to Xerox or something? Like, not Xerox, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
You know, Xerox and Infosys. There's a bunch of companies that Fujitsu, and if they're still around. Anyway, there's, you know, I'm going back from years and years ago.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Who the names I remember. But yeah, we're back to square one now, where now you pay somebody, they set up a data center in your building or wherever, and they run it for you,
mm-hmm.
and that's innovation somehow.
Yeah, I know. It's a little weird. It's strange. You take a step back and it's like, haven't we already done this before?
Yeah. Apparently AWS have a thing called Outpost, which is a fully managed service that extends AWS infrastructure, AWS services and APIs and tools. Yeah. So basically, Microsoft are getting free data center space to run part of Azure. Now, the question is will they be able to run other customers' workloads in that same spot, or is it really private? Like, that'll be...
That's interesting. Yeah, I wonder.
Yeah. Wouldn't that be cool, though? Like, imagine if you could lower your data center costs by effectively doing what AWS did when they started AWS, right? Which was, you had all this hardware sitting around for Black Friday and for the holiday shopping season that they weren't using because during the rest of the year because of peak loads were right down.
Mm.
And so they started renting out capacity to other people, and that's how AWS came to be, right? And imagine now Microsoft could do a similar thing, saying, there are all these server rooms and server closets that are now empty because of the cloud. If you let us put hardware in there and you cool it and feed it and power it, mm-hmm. right, then we'll give you you'll get Azure, right? And you'll get it for, I don't know, a certain amount of percentage off because we're renting out the unused capacity to other people.
Yeah, it's an interesting model. It's curious like how much of a validation that they have before they do it. So like, do I get a significant discount if I'm okay having my Azure compute running inside of this company down the street that may not be as capable or as secure and not as locked down.
Sure.
So I'm like,
yeah, sure.
But Microsoft's on the hook, mate.
You can't provide the same level of security when you don't provide the same level of physical security as Microsoft data centers would. So there's definitely that aspect.
It seems to me like you're opening yourself up to an additional complexity that you don't have to do. You know, it's, I mean, to me,
my take is that the Azure Stack was already in that camp, right?
It was.
It sounds like customers, and I'm reading between the lines, were having problems running it. Or the vendors that built the Azure Stacks, right? I can't remember. HP was one of them, perhaps.
Yeah, HP was one.
Having problems supporting it or something like that. And so this way, Microsoft gets more control over the hardware that they ship out to a customer, how it's managed and how it's run, because they get use all their experience for doing that with Azure. And maybe it's an easier way to run Azure Stack from that perspective.
Yeah, maybe. I'd be curious to see how this goes.
Yeah, for sure. Right. Last note before we get on to our picks. Did we mention memory is serving me poorly, but did we mention that Ignite's being split in two?
This was news to me, so I don't think so.
Okay. So on August the 6th, Chris Kapp from Microsoft, who's the chief marketing officer, announced that Ignite, Microsoft Ignite conference, is going to be split into two events. The first one is a two-day event, September 22nd, and the other one is going to be sometime early next year, next calendar year.
Mm-hmm.
This really, really changes things for me for Ignite. Right?
Mm-hmm.
It'll be, I think now we'll see Ignite being less about learning stuff mm-hmm. and the sessions and all that, and more just a big marketing event for Microsoft announcements.
That's kind of what we've seen so far. I didn't tune into the Inspire conference. In fact, I completely forgot that it was even going on. But Build felt a lot like that. The GitHub conference felt a lot like that. It was just announcements. There was not a lot of learning. It was more just like a focus place to where, this may not be a fair way to say it, but I think it's descriptive of how I feel about it. These virtual events this year have turned into being a way for Microsoft to do their moments that they shoot for.
Yep.
Like they've got their fall moment, their spring moment, and they still need to have their moments, but you lose the other, which is all the announcements, but you lose everything else. You lose any kind of an interaction. You lose any kind of learning. I see product announcements, but I don't really see anything else. And so it feels like, I mean, I know that, you know, part of this is they're splitting it up into two events. One's going to be this year. One's going to be early next year. They're canceling all of the Ignite Tour events that happen in different cities. They're still going to do Build next year. This one that's happening at the beginning of 2021 is not going to replace Build. But the excitement or the anticipation of these events is not nearly there for the in-person ones. And it's not because they're virtual versus being online. It's just that the way that they're being implemented is just giant, like you said, they're giant marketing pitches, giant market product announcements. And
it's going to be two-day events. Yeah. I think this could be, again, reading between the lines, Microsoft learned from the other virtual events it's done to date that they're not great learning activities, mm-hmm. right? That people don't engage, that it takes a lot more work than it's worth to pull off for as little engagement as they get.
Mm-hmm.
And they're basically like, people are not engaging, so we are just going to use them for marketing events. And a 4 or a 5 day event makes no sense for that. So we're going to cut it back to two and we're going to bang out a bunch of news.
They might want to look at the way that they're implementing the events too and just being like, look, it was hard as hell to figure out where sessions were when we were looking at Build.
Oh, it was absolute shambles.
Wonder.
Yeah, anyway.
Why weren't people interacting? They didn't know where to go.
I had no idea where to go. Yeah, exactly. So it's changed a bit. And we will see, you know, Microsoft was not going to run an in-person event in September anyway. They'd already postponed them.
Mm-hmm.
But now they're basically cutting it back and splitting it into two. And yeah, we'll see how it goes.
Yeah.
Right. Shall we get on to some picks?
Let's start picking. AC's Voitanos delivers on-demand video-based training for developers on the latest SharePoint extensibility model from Microsoft in his course, Mastering the SharePoint Framework. Back to the show.
All right, AC, what do you got for us this week?
So I have two. Neither one of them are tech or work related at all. So the first one is a Netflix. I guess it's not technically Netflix. It's on Netflix, but it came from ESPN. It's called The Last Dance.
Mm.
Back when I was a kid, I was an NBA fan, big basketball fan. And I've lost a lot of the NBA has lost a lot of the appeal for me over the years. I'm trying to get back into it now because just other organized sports just isn't happening. And NBA is one of the few that's actually doing this right. Well, in my opinion, they are succeeding in what they're pulling off. We're able to see a season without things getting interrupted. And what The Last Dance is a documentary that goes back and looks at the Chicago Bulls dynasty. And they called it The Last Dance because the last season was referred to as The Last Dance. Because prior to the season, the general manager and the owner effectively told the players and the coach that we're tearing it apart at the end of this year, that we're you know, things, the market value, they started doing the business side of it. Like, you know, these, everyone's so much more expensive as a piece. We can't afford to keep everybody together. And if we start taking things, if we start, you know, pawning some people off, it's not the same thing. And so it's time to, you know, we've had our run. This is good. And so the coach went to the team and said, this is the last dance. I'm not coming back. A lot of guys aren't coming back. And they were like, our goal is to win. We have to win this year and to do the second three-peat and then we're done. Hmm. Man, I tell you, from my family was out of town last week. I got binged on, I started binging on this thing, watching two episodes a night. It's 10 episodes long. And it is just, if you're like my age, like mid-40s, early 40s, God, that's scary to say. And you were into NBA back then, you follow the stuff. This just like some, it was just took me down a memory lane, like nostalgic awesome. Kind of stuff. And it was, man, the very end, the music that they paired with it, a bunch of Pearl Jam stuff, the very end was just, is awesome. I just watched a friend of mine, I told a friend of mine about it. He's had it on his list. He finally watched it. He pinged me this morning, told me about it. He just watched it. I was like, man, wasn't it just glorious? And I went back and I watched the last like 10 minutes of the last episode again this morning. And it's just, it is fantastic.
I've got it on my list.
So it's really good. And if you were an NBA fan, you would have liked it. The other thing is a book that I'm reading, or a series, a saga that I'm reading. I just finished the first one. The concept is really cool. The first book was fantastic. I'm not going to tell you what the titles are of the other ones because it kind of gives away what happens in the first one. But it's called The Fear Saga. And the first one is Fear of the Sky. And the concept is there is another humanoid-like species from another planet way outside of our solar system that is more technically advanced than us. Similar to humans, they have effectively not filled up, but they've every corner of the globe, of their globe, is occupied. They need to start expanding and they're looking for another place to live. Earth is a good place to live. And the concept here is they're coming to Earth and the goal is to get rid of all humans so that they can come in and take over an empty house. And how are they going to do it? And the challenges that they have to deal with. The first episode was really first book. Yeah. First book was really, really good. Huh. I couldn't put it down.
Nice. Nice. So, I will add that to my reading list too.
How about you? What you got?
I got a couple. The first one is sort of frightening. It is a New Yorker article called How Vulnerable is GPS? And it's quite a long read, but it is fascinating. It goes through sort of the history of GPS. And, you know, GPS is old, right? It is an old piece of technology now. And basically the premise of the article is talking about a researcher back in 2012 who effectively took down or hijacked GPS. Not hijacked, that's the wrong word. Fooled GPS and manipulated GPS to his own ends, right? And he did this in front of a whole bunch of people from the military and government and things like that. He did it in a legit way, but he basically proved that you can, you know, hijack GPS and use it for your own purposes. And it's horrifying. Like, it talks about basically jamming GPS, spoofing GPS. He's gone and got data from ships that suddenly appear inland when they're approaching particular ports, for example. What's also very interesting is he talks about following, you know, some of these incidents of weird GPS stuff that's gone on have been when leaders of foreign countries have been in town, right? So they basically insinuate that when certain leaders like Putin and Xi Jinping and things like that go to different countries, they take effectively GPS spoofers with them, electronic countermeasures, and so that, you know, like GPS guided missiles, for example, or missiles, you know, weapons that use GPS for targeting, smart bombs, all that sort of stuff, will be off and won't be able to target them.
Oh my God.
And so there's certain spots in the world that you can see this in action. And if you go there, you'll start appearing in weird places.
No way.
Yeah. It's a good read. Yeah.
I saw this article. Yes. I did not read it. It's on my list now. This is that. I didn't realize that that's what it went into. That's really cool.
Yeah.
I think.
And it just talks about how catastrophic this could be. Like, there are systems in the world that use GPS, not for positioning, but for timing synchronization, for example. Right. Because there's a very accurate atomic clock that's used for synchronization of GPS signals. And it affects all sorts of things. And so it can have a really profound, like, computer systems start. There were issues with GPS at one point where there was a time sync issue in a couple of satellites, mm-hmm. and it threw off, like, there were computer and banking systems that went down across the world. There's, like, stock trading systems rely on the atomic clock signal from GPS to know if people were sending trades before they said they were and all sorts of stuff, right? Jeez. So it has profound impacts and all sorts of stuff.
That's really cool.
So that's the first one. Great article to go read. The second one is called Boeing 747s Still Get Critical Updates Via Floppy Disks. It's an interesting article on The Verge about, with coronavirus, there's been a bunch of aircraft being retired sooner than they normally would have been, mm-hmm. right? And this one in particular is a 747 had very recently been retired, like within the last couple of months. And a hacker does a tour of the Boeing 747 as part of his presentation for DEF CON and goes down into the avionics bay of 747 and shows you around, like, how antiquated the systems are on it, right? In some ways antiquated. And then sort of talks about the threats that they pose and how it's different on modern aircraft and the networking, how stuff communicates with one another on new aircraft versus old aircraft. And just a really interesting glimpse into some of the, I guess, less common types of stuff like that you get to see. Because you don't get to go tour the avionics bay of a 747 very often.
No, it's funny seeing the pictures in that article too, the floppy disk storage bay and the place where you insert a new floppy disk.
Apparently, this is an aircraft that was flying about 2 months ago, right? So it was a current aircraft and it gets its updates for its avionics systems and things through floppy disks because it's the tried and true method that was done back then when they built these systems and don't fix what ain't broken, I guess, especially when it comes to aircraft.
Do you see that last sentence in this article? The United States Defense Department only ended use of an 8-inch floppy disk for coordinating of the country's nuclear forces in this past October, and the ISS is full of floppy disks.
Yeah. I mean, ISS has been up there for 20 years, right?
God.
Longer than 20 years, I think. Yeah. So it's it's fascinating. Like, if you remember reading Command and Control?
Oh, yeah.
A book about nukes and how some of the systems and how things communicate with one another and stuff like that. Oh my goodness.
It's scary.
It wouldn't surprise me if floppy disks were still used in a bunch of places, along with Windows XP for some quite critical systems. Oh, in the video, you should watch the video because they do a bit of a tour of the 747 and in one spot it's got a little piece about the computer that they use for like cabin controls and the in-flight entertainment system.
Yeah.
And they just said, this computer that the flight crew used to control the stuff is running Windows NT.
Wow.
Yep.
A fear that I always have when I was doing more like production, you know, big client work and production deployments and stuff, I always feared doing a deployment because if stuff was working, if I don't touch it, it'll just continue to work. But if we're going to roll something in, it could break. And with a plane,
yep.
I mean, you think about the downside.
Mm. Well, they mentioned a good point. They said, you know, you change things. Often you've got to go through really long recertification processes for a lot of stuff. And, you know, you touch things, you got to recertify them. So don't touch them.
Yeah, leave it alone.
Anyway, great insight. It made me sort of sad to think 747s won't be flying anymore very soon because they're just, I don't know, queens of the sky, I suppose. And
it's a workhorse.
Amazing aircraft. Yeah. I wonder, have I taken my last trip on a 747?
Yeah, it's a good question, especially I've done one flight on like a, what's the big one? The A380. I've done one flight on one of those.
Might be the last time on that too.
Might be the last time on that one.
I've flown an A380 a couple of times this year, once earlier this year and a 747 earlier this year. Mm. And it could be the last time I fly on both of those aircraft.
I am happy, though, to say that my only A380 flight, though, was at the front of the bus.
Yeah.
That was a cool experience. But being flying first class, like in a 747 downstairs, like in the nose where it kind of comes together, that was a really cool seat.
Good experience.
Yeah.
747s, there's just something special about them to me.
Yeah.
It's like they're old, right? Mm-hmm. So they've got that kind of like when you were a kid, you kind of like, wow, that's huge.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And then they've got a stairwell in them.
Yeah.
I just found that like, totally mesmerizing as a kid.
That was cool.
Yeah.
Cool deal.
All right, man. Well, let's wrap up for this week. It's good chatting. I think you're going to be flying solo next week with me being out. I'm heading out to the coast with the family for a bit of R&R. So I will talk to you when I get back.
I will hold the fort down. We will make sure that we don't burn the podcast to the ground while you're out, and we'll be ready.
Oh, great.
Our sponsors will be happy to hear that too.
Yeah.
Otherwise, turn in next week for an epic burner.
That's right. All right, see. Have a good one.
Yeah, man. Take care.
Did you like this episode? Please tweet about it and drop a 5-star review in your favorite podcast app. It helps people find out about our show and grow our audience, and we'd really appreciate it. If you have a question for us, go to microsoftcloudshow.com/questions, where you can submit it as text or record it as a wave or MP3 and provide us a link so we can play it on the show. You can also subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, the Google Play Store, Spotify, or your podcatcher of choice. And finally, sign up for our mailing list by heading over to microsoftcloudshow.com, where you'll get notices of each episode as well as the show notes sent to you directly each week. We'll be back with a new episode next week. Thanks for listening.